What's the announcement you're most excited about from NVIDIA GTC? Vioma Gagere is an AI technical solutions architect. Vioma, welcome back to the show. What did you think?
Thank you. And I feel the Groot N1 model, the generalist model that they're calling it for humanoid robotics, was something that I really enjoyed.
Kautar Al-Mighraoui is a principal research scientist and manager at the AI Hardware Center. Kautar, welcome back to the show. What did you see from the keynote that you liked?
Thank you. Great to be here. I was also very excited about the robotics and simulation announcement, especially the Newton physics engine for real-time physics simulation and how, you know, it's working with the AI.
Natalie Barricaldo is a senior research scientist and master inventor. Natalie, welcome back to the show. We haven't seen you for a while. What did you like from GTC?
I was super excited with their framework to generate synthetic data for robots because that has been a key factor for reducing the performance of robots in all sorts of applications. So super excited about that. I guess we're all into robots here.
Yeah, absolutely. All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the best minds in artificial intelligence to walk you through the biggest headlines of the week. As always, there's a lot to cover. We're going to talk about Baidu's new models that they've dropped, a paper about the flaws of chain-of-thought reasoning, and Gemini 2.0 Flash Experimental. But first, I really want to cover NVIDIA GTC. GTC is NVIDIA's sort of big conference that they do every year. It's where the big drops happen. Jensen Huang gets to walk out on stage and do all the exciting keynotes. Sounds like this group really wants to talk about robots, and specifically Groot N1, which is a foundation model for robots that NVIDIA announced during the keynote. Vioma, maybe I'll start with you. What got you so excited about this announcement?
One of the things that I saw is like a model such as Groot N1 created by NVIDIA, which is trained on both the synthetic and the real data. And NVIDIA were during that keynote, they were claiming that it features like a dual system architecture. So it's thinking fast and slow, which is kind of inspired by that human cognitive processes that we see. So I feel these are the small ways in which people are trying to get towards AGI. Like, let's get a little bit closer. Let's get a little bit closer, however far it seems. So I feel that was a good catch that they were trying to do in that part. Yeah,
absolutely. And I know, Natalie, in your response, you kind of flagged this kind of synthetic data part being the thing that got you the most excited. I know that's been a little bit of a blocker, but it made me good for our listeners to kind of understand how big of a blocker it has been sort of traditionally, if you want to talk a little bit to that.
Yes, definitely. So one of the big issues that we have is that when you are trying to simulate a robot to test it before it goes into the real environment, we have limited data. And traditionally, what has happened is that when you simulate, which is less expensive, you don't have the exact kind of a spectrum of different types of scenarios where the robot might move. And as a result, when you move your machine learning programming into the actual robot, it fails. And there are like these very nice videos of how it fails. So if you have a humanoid, it may just fall on their face and it's just crazy. So that's why a lot of the different robots at companies and actual factories, they have a very restricted set of environments. You see them going down and up, for example, if it's an arm and so forth. And it's just because it's very, very complex to create a robot that can move in an environment that may not be exactly the one it was designed for. So just moving a little bit, a millimeter or something, the robot may not behave as properly. And having this type of synthetic generation of data allow us to basically create a huge environment where we can test this and make the whole development cycle much faster and much safer. So another aspect to it is that because these robots, as they evolve more, they move around, you may have situations where you have unknown safety things happening. And that is super interesting to me because understanding how we can make all those environments really safe and try to simulate things that go wrong before the robot actually gets deployed, I think it's just fascinating. It opens a lot of different new opportunities to create safe robots and safe applications and deploy them in real life. So I am super excited when they said also they open source it. I was very, very excited to hear that.
Yeah, the additional kind of open source element, I think, is like a really interesting part of this because they've clearly created like something that's like a big deal from a model standpoint, but they're just saying, actually, we're here to sell hardware, right? So we actually have like ways of the business incentives lean towards things like open source. Kato, you spend your days thinking about all things hardware. How big of a deal is this? And why is NVIDIA getting into robots? You know, like I think about NVIDIA, like they started as like a gaming GPU company. And then, you know, like the next time we really thought about them, it was like, oh man, we're going to do these big data centers for language models. And it kind of sounds like a lot of this keynote was robots, 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 right? We're going to show you videos of robots. We're going to bring a robot onto the stage. Why is NVIDIA kind of investing in this vertical?
I think it's high time right now to invest in this. And this is very attractive. I think all the ingredients right now are coming together. You know, the models, the hardware, the simulations, the synthetic data generations all are coming together, which makes these robots really perform very well. So I think the collaboration that they have with DeepMind and Disney, I also was interested in seeing Disney also play a role here. And especially if they're going to bring, you know, that maybe, the fun, the entertainment piece of it, their Disney characters or, you know, kind of play that into these robots, that's going to be really interesting. So one thing also that was very interesting is this physics engine that they talked about, which is designed for these robotic simulation. Natalie mentioned this. And another thing, it's also built on their RAP framework, which provides a lot of acceleration. So it provides, you know, this high fidelity and real-time analytics simulations, which was not, you know, kind of possible or realistic before. And this is very crucial for training and testing these robotic systems in virtual environments before even deploying them in real world. So I think that is a very big step forward to enable these humanoid robots to perform well and with high fidelity. So combining basically the simulation and the AI acceleration using this RAP-based acceleration framework that they have with high-performance parallel programming, it helps them achieve, you know, fast and efficient GPU-accelerated simulations. So they're kind of combining the AI world with the physics-based simulations to provide, you know, this interesting outcome. And they also have these integrations with their existing frameworks, like the SHAC lab, with their reinforcement learning. And I think they also have a playground that uses DeepMind's robotics research. A lot of, you know, integration with existing frameworks. And so that really makes this high precision robotic control possible and paving a great environment that is ideal for simulating tasks such as, you know, manipulation, grasping, multimodality, et cetera.
Yeah. And I guess a follow-up question for you there, Kautar, is, you know, in the last few episodes, I feel like every few episodes we do a segment where it's like, oh, but, you know, OpenAI is about to work on its own chip or, you know, Amazon might be catching up. You know, there's lots of people who kind of want to like, you know, capture some of NVIDIA's market. But, you know, I kind of look at all of this robotics work they're doing and also just the announcements about like Blackwell Dynamo, right? It's just like the performance metrics are just like insane. I guess from your opinion, kind of as someone who thinks about this a lot and watches the industry, like, can anyone catch up? Like, it kind of just feels like after this keynote, it's like, feels like very hard for anyone to really credibly claim that they're going to kind of like do things kind of on par with NVIDIA, particularly because they have this ecosystem. But I'm curious about how you think about that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is, they're kind of creating this big gap. And they're also lining up the right collaborators like DeepMind and Disney and others. So it's going to be hard to catch up. But I wouldn't be surprised if somebody comes with some contributions, like either from OpenAI or I think we'll have to see. Although I agree with you, it's really difficult, you know, to catch up.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other announcements that were done at the keynote. And, you know, Natalie, in particular, I kind of thought of you. So, you know, a few episodes ago, we talked a little bit about a project they announced, I think at one of the last keynotes, called Digits, which was this, like, candidly, like, quite cute little supercomputer that they were selling that would be sort of like a desktop. I'm kind of curious, as like someone who's a researcher, you know, if like that kind of form factor for doing work is interesting to you. I just think a little bit about, I have a friend at a company being like, our product's getting really successful, but that means we're burning all of our compute on like inference. We have no time to do any like training or fine tuning work anymore. And there's been kind of this like tension of like, oh, well, all of the compute resources for an organization kind of come out of the same bucket. And I guess I'm kind of curious, like, does something like DGX Spark, which is what it's called now, like, is that something that's interesting? I don't know if you put your name in to kind of reserve one of these devices, but I'm curious about how you think about it.
I would pass that question to Qatar, actually. I'm not sure how to answer that.
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, it's going to open up the doors for many researchers and enthusiasts and people who are interested in learning about, you know, all of these different cycles in the AI journey. So of course, there is a lot of focus on the inferencing and the inference scaling, because, you know, I think the need for that stems from the fact that it's very hard to get access to these GPUs. So we had to come up and be creative about, you know, what can we do with the resources that we have available. But I feel like there is a lot that can be done even, you know, in the pre-training and the fine-tuning stages. It's just because only a few people or few organizations are really limited because of this, the resource constraints that we have right now. So I would love to have access, you know, to AI in a box that I can use in my home and experiment with all these different things and then push the boundaries even further. And I'm sure many others would have that appetite as well.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of like a cool, I mean, I guess I'm a little bit of a device nerd. I was just like, oh, it's just like amazing that you can have that much computing power just like on your desktop right now.
Exactly.
And yeah, I think it's like very, very exciting. Vyom, any thoughts on DGX Spark? I don't know if you like had seen that announcement.
Yeah.
If you think it's more of a gimmick or it's like the kind of thing you'd actually be interested in playing around with.
I feel the reason why they came up with this also is to target the developer community, that the developers sitting at home or even want to try something as a side project, because that's how innovation kind of flows. Someone's side project, if I have the compute to do it, it opens my creativity mind doors, if you may call that. So it helps you experiment, train, like let's say even if you want to fine tune a small little thing and move on. So fail fast kind of works very, very well on this. And I feel that will be the reason why people want to adapt more. That, okay, I have this, I can leverage this, learn about it, try seeing if this works or not, let's move on. So no longer are you going to see big companies or big institutions spending a lot of time and energy on like innovation projects because someone somewhere would have tried it and be like, hey guys, it's not going to work, let's move on. So I feel that a quick turnaround is something that is the angle that NVIDIA is trying to play here as well.
If I might add here, I think, of course, you know, all the points that Vyoma said are great. So this is kind of bringing AI supercomputing to the desktop, trying also to democratize AI. But I think there is also this angle of the robotics, the humanoid AI training at scale, which I think that was also one of their motivation, is basically pushing these humanoid robotics forward with models like the GR00T. And why DGX here matters, it allows, you know, developers to fine tune and deploy these robotics models locally. So using, you know, their Newton physics engine, and it allows also this enabling simulation to real-time training. So you need, you know, these capabilities locally to be able to advance these things. And I think it would be also great for students that are learning about AI. They need to learn all these concepts. And the best way to learn is to experiment and have these hands-on experiences. So students right now are struggling to get access to GPUs and resources.
Yeah, it'll be really cool if there's like kind of a big schools or education kind of market for these types of devices. I just think about when like the, you know, the Macintosh or like the kind of the first iMac laptops came out. It was like a huge thing. Like Apple had a huge market selling to schools because everybody wanted to give computers to their kids. And it was like a great way to kind of break into people learning how to, you know, like use these devices. So I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Baidu announced this week that they were launching two new models. One's called Ernie X1, and the other one is Ernie 4.5. And X1 is supposed to be their DeepSeek competitor. And of course, Baidu is like a long-standing, you know, Chinese tech company, really one of the leaders in the space. You know, I think in many ways, kind of like one of the people that you would have expected to kind of really dominate in AI. And almost like a lot of other players in the space, like OpenAI, you know, it's like they too are now kind of struggling with all of these new competitors coming up, right? Like, you know, what's interesting about Ernie X1 and Ernie 4.5 is they're both closed-sourced models. And so I guess maybe as a first cut, like curious about, you know, how folks think a little bit about sort of open source here. And I guess why we think Baidu is still trying to pursue like a closed source strategy. You know, I'm kind of curious if you have any thoughts on like why they're still playing this game. And if, you know, you really think ultimately they're going to have to open source just like many others are thinking about now.
Yeah. I feel Baidu is a kind of company which stemmed from the point that they wanted to create a search engine for China, and they wanted to keep majority of that data private, a lot of data privacy inhibitions that they were going through as well. So I feel this is like their chance to kind of utilize some of the information, the knowledge graph, if you might say, that they have created between their different AI applications like Baidu AI for like search or like Baidu AI for maps, etc. So they are trying to come up with like a platform interface with that one particular model, which kind of creates synergy across. So I think A1, that is that. I always believe that, yes, sooner or later, they are going to realize that the open source market would be some sort of a better way to take this forward, like how Sam Altman, after a couple of years, has to say it in an AMA on Reddit that, hey, I think maybe we're on the other side of history.
He's getting kind of like dragged into it.
Exactly. I don't think he wanted to say it. It's just that it just came out, right? So I feel that as well. But looking at Baidu's like core structure, they were always like very privacy integrated systems or something that they believed in building. So I get where their mind is right now, but I think sooner or later they are going to have to move. And the pricing that they've kept, it's almost like half of what DeepSeek or the others are. So that is another point that, see guys, everyone's going to use us. We are like half as expensive. So they have like an up in the market as is. So they're like, maybe we're going to leverage this as much as we can till we can. And then we'll see when we get there.
Yeah, the competitive dynamics are really interesting. Natalie, I kind of take a look at the situation and, you know, Vyom is a good reminder, right? Like this is like, Baidu is like the kind of Google of its market, right? The kind of search engine of its market. And I guess I kind of look at that and I say, well, you know, the kind of reputation has been that like Google has been kind of slow to capture the opportunity from AI. And I say, oh, it's okay. It's very interesting that in China also like the search engine company is the one that's been kind of like slow to capture this. I don't know, should we read into anything in that? Do you think that there's like something about search businesses or search companies or, you know, dominant kind of, you know, these types of search companies that are like maybe more limited in using or benefiting from AI?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, because the way I see it is that probably they don't need to open source in the sense that they already have a big user base. So people are already trusting them with so many things. So potentially from the strategy perspective, open sourcing would not be a key priority as it is for other companies. The other aspect that every time I think about open source models versus having a more closed source model, from the security standpoint of view, when you have an open source model, you are telling people, hey, just go inspect it. We try our best. Tell us how you think we did. And that it's offering a lot of transparency. And I think it improves how we move forward. Now, when other companies keep their models behind the scenes and you're just basically not telling how it works exactly, they may be planning, for example, to orchestrate different types of components in the backend. And I think we'll see, just like as we see with OpenAI, we are not fully sure how many models they have behind the scene. We know we have guardrails and a lot of things. So I think not fully open sourcing in because they already have such a big base for search, then they probably are thinking it's okay to go that way. But as you know, I'm a security person and I like transparency. It makes it easier to test the system and so forth. So yeah, that's my take on open source versus non-open source and what they are doing.
Yeah, for sure. Kautar, are you on Team Vioma? Like, do you feel like this closed source strategy is doomed? You know, we're going to see Baidu have to open source in the future. Or do you think there's kind of like maybe different things going on in that market?
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with Natalie, but I see that they've already started making a step forward towards open source. And I think they've announced that they're planning to open source sometimes in June. Their ERNIE models. And this just shows that they are also competing with OpenAI and DeepSeek, and especially seeing all the, all the buzz that DeepSeek created. So open sourcing AI models like DeepSeek, they've gained traction. And Baidu is likely sees this as a way to increase also adoption of its own models. And so also a way to gain market share, attract developers, build an ecosystem around its models. Because if you keep these things closed, you're missing, you know, in terms of this open ecosystem and developers and getting also the community to help. And especially the adoption. I think the adoption is kind of goes hand in hand with the open source, especially. So that is very important. So driving this widespread adoption, more developers, more use cases, widespread adoption, faster improvements through also these external contributions. Those are all win-win strategies when you use open source. And I think Baidu is getting it. And it's moving also towards that direction. And this is just, you know, it just intensifies the competition in China, but also globally. So it's interesting to see these dynamics.
So the next thing I think I want to talk a little bit about is I like to always have like a paper that we can discuss. I'm a little bit kind of old fashioned in that sense. We talk a lot about industry news, but I think it's just fun seeing what's going on in the world of research and kind of interesting papers from week to week. And this paper caught my eye. So the title of the paper is Chain of Thought Reasoning in the Wild is Not Always Faithful. And so for those of you who have kind of not super aware of chain of thought and kind of reasoning models and exactly how this is looking right now we have these kind of like chain of thought reasoning traces, where, you know, a model will kind of think through a problem to greater or lesser degree before it kind of like renders an answer. And, you know, overall, right, like we've sort of discovered this method is really, really good in terms of getting the model to perform better and better. But there's this kind of increasing sort of series of papers, this is not the only one, that kind of are investigating the problem of what happens when the model gives you erroneous reasoning for the decision that it's trying to make. And when is basically sort of these reasoning traces not actually a faithful way of understanding how models make decisions. And Natalie, you think a lot about security. and I think this kind of paper really raises a bunch of security issues. In the sense of like, maybe we are giving people the wrong impression of how AIs actually think by giving them chain of thought traces. Is that the right way of kind of thinking about this paper and I guess kind of the problems of chain of thought in general?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I'd rather have chain of thought so that I can know at least a little bit how the model came to an answer. What the paper shows is a lot of biases that may happen in that chain of thought itself. So, and I think the reason it is really interesting is because the particular bias that they are demonstrating in the paper is a bias that it's also in us humans. So, for example, if I ask you, Tim, a question, is X larger than Y, depending on the way I phrase the question, a lot of people would answer one way versus another. So that's this cognitive bias that we know for sure and cognitive psychologists have for so long studied Now, where that paper in particular shows that that same bias exists in this model. And I thought that was interesting. And there's like the parallel in the cognitive psychology for humans versus that paper. And I think that's just why people are like, oh my gosh, this is so interesting. If you study further this type of situation, what you'll see is that the models also exhibit a lot of other types of biases. Now, in particular for fairness, for example, there are some papers like in 01, there was a very interesting section that I read about how the chain of thought itself may be pretty hateful, for example, or may tell you stuff that you as a user don't want to necessarily see or expose to certain for certain use cases. So overall, I thought it was really interesting paper. The caveat, and because I am a researcher at heart, is that they only had one data set and their temperature was 0.7, which I thought was interesting. So that goes into a lot of detail about the paper, but I would like to see like more expansion on this work because it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Vilma, did you agree? I think I'm curious if you saw things that you were sort of interested in the paper. I mean, you know, from that, I think it's kind of interesting is like on the temperature point is like, I don't know, how much should we believe these results, right? Like it actually maybe turns out that by and large, reasoning traces are really useful as a way of kind of like understanding how the model's making decisions. And maybe we shouldn't be so scared. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I do agree with Natalie on that point that when it's at the temperature point, you're actually telling it to be a little bit more creative in its thinking as is. And now you're using that as a base of saying that COD is not here to stay, it's gone. I feel it is here to stay because it kind of tells you what it's going through. And the other part is the people, like all these companies which have come up with these models, the reasoning models, now they are looking into how to make the chain of thought processes better. So I feel you can, like right now we see a lot of pattern matching than having something which is like a more generalized way in which you can understand the deep reasoning. But going further, what about a reverse COD? Like whatever a COD has given you in the information, go back and evaluate it again. Tell me if that chain of thought was right or not. So there can be innovative ways in which researchers, etc., will go on answering. I feel it is here to stay and it should. So I'll just give you a short example. I moved and I'm looking for a sofa in my apartment. And what I was looking is, I said I want a Japandi style sofa with a table. And then it just started giving me a Japandi table. But I knew that because I read it in that entire reasoning that, oh, now it's just going and spinning on that table thing. I don't want that. Then I went and said, I want a side table. And then again, it went and told me that, no, it's a table. So I'm trying to tell you that I understood that I have to be so specific. I want an adjustable, low level side table. And so that is, I wouldn't have done any of that had it just spun and I would have been, okay, it's going to give me a Japandi style sofa someday. So I feel those are ways in which it tells you to improve your prompt, tells you that this is not, right now chain of thought is also based a little bit on your prompt. It doesn't tell you the exact model internal workings, but I feel it will evolve with time. It should evolve with time and it will. I mean, people are working on it. So.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting things. I never really thought about it that way, but kind of the chain of thought's useful for letting you know when the reasoning is definitely off. Even though it may not necessarily be a good guide for like when it got it right, how it got it right. But it's like, it's kind of a debugging tool more than anything else, which I think is like a really fun way of thinking about it. Kautar, I think I would love to get you to comment on one comment that Natalie had, which is it's very funny that these models have kind of inherited all of these cognitive biases that humans have, which is very funny. I mean, computers didn't used to have those types of biases, but I guess we live in a world now where, you know, that's the case. I know someone who kind of like thinks about sort of like hardware, which I always kind of envision as a much more kind of like structured, you know, thing. It feels like we've kind of like these computers are now kind of like, you know, executing systems that have like all of these weird kind of like soft emotional aspects to them. And it's just like, I don't know, I'm curious to hear your reflection on that. It's like a very funny kind of contrast to what we thought about computers doing,
exactly,
you know, even 10 years ago.
Computers used to be exact, you know, zeros and ones, and we expect them to be kind of the opposite of biased. But right now, because they're learning with AI, it's learning from the data, and this data is generated by us. So it has inherited all of our biases. And the way these models are learning, I think it's only natural to see, you know, these outcomes that we have to figure out systematic ways to solving them. So Vioma, I think, mentioned some of them. So of course, you know, this is unveiling this chain of thought is unable to generalize, and it also accumulates all these errors the longer the chain of reasoning is, which, you know, leads this faulty logic despite, you know, these correct answers. But, you know, as Vioma mentioned, I think there are potential solutions. And I also agree that this is something here to stay, especially the interpretability aspect of it is so important that I think we need only to amplify the importance of this. So we definitely need things like self-correction modules. Claude, for example, has this constitutional AI, which is a reflection-based approach that helps to self-correct the model. There's also things like structured step verification, these hybrid models where neurosymbolic reasoning, like the tree of thought, for example, can also be used to help correct, you know, the logic. You know, also combining things like statistical logical AI with probabilistic reasoning, with logical constraints, all of these techniques, I think, need to be brought into the table. So to figure out how do we combine neurosymbolic AI approaches to improve the reasoning aspects of these LLMs. And having also this self-verification in the reasoning and self-correcting, which I think, you know, will keep COT useful and reduce the flawlessness in these tools. So I think these hybrid reasoning frameworks will be necessary to improve the reliability and the reasoning of these models.
Yeah, we'll definitely see that, I think. And it is kind of a funny outcome that, like, we created this like chain of thought thing, which at times can be very emotional. You read the chain of thought and, like, I read one that was like, oh, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can at my job. Okay, let's try to research this task. And then you're kind of trying to, like, make it more computer. It makes me think a little bit about, like, people will say, oh, he's like a computer. And, like, I think, like, maybe 20 years ago, that would mean that the person is, like, very rigid and very logical. It's almost kind of, I think, a little bit about, like, maybe, you know, kids growing up today will be like, oh, he's like a computer. And by that, they mean, you know, really irrational and emotional. And, you know, it'd be very funny if it kind of, like, flips what we mean when we say, oh, like, this person is like a computer, or they're thinking like a computer.
Imagine that notebook LM with COT. So let's say you see the chain of thought, and like in notebook LM, you can pause it. That no, don't go there. Don't think like this. Change this. And then that can be used as a training data set. I feel it's going to open new avenues for the prompt engineering aspect as well. People will learn how to make prompt engineering more robust, scalable, more precise with time.
And I think this also could help with the customizations. The way you interact with the model might be very different from, you know, how Tim interacted or how Natalie interacts with the model. So that, you know, I think localizations, customizations might also be interesting. So you can also inject cultural cues and preferences. So Tim, I think it's going to even be more biases that we're introducing to these models.
Yeah, it's a question of what kind of biases you want, I guess, right?
It's going to be, I think, both this hybrid world.
I'm going to move us on to our final topic. We talked a little bit, I think I mentioned a little bit on our kind of segment on Baidu, which is, again, like, kind of the narrative that's been in the market, or at least on Twitter, right, is basically that, you know, Google's coming from behind. They should have captured, you know, the AI revolution, and they kind of missed it, and now they're catching up. But it's kind of like week to week, it feels like Google's like really catching up now. Like, there's just all of these launches, which are like quite impressive. Google recently announced, and this is like almost kind of a joke in AI now, like, they launched a model called Gemini 2.0 Flash Experimental, which is basically a model that they had in beta for a small group of people, but it is now widely available. And it's an image gen model that people can play with. So this by itself maybe wouldn't be kind of super impressive, though the model itself is pretty fun to play with. But I wanted to kind of use it as an opportunity to talk a little bit about one particular aspect of the launch, which is that Google is touting that one of the reasons why its model, you know, its 2.0 Flash model experimental, is so good is that it incorporates what they call world knowledge to make the image generation better. And, you know, like many phrases in AI, you're like, well, okay, world knowledge, what does that even mean? And I guess, Vioma, maybe I'll start with you. Like, what is world knowledge anyways? And why is it important, I think, to like AI generation, particularly in images?
Correct. So that's a good point that you said that first I want to answer this thing that is Google really catching up? So the hot take. I feel catching up.
I mean, that's just vibes. I don't have any industry stats, so feel free to knock me down there.
No,
so.
I get it. I've been asked this like many times now, like outside speaking sessions as well, because catching up is like very subjective. My question here is the real question is, are these models going to surpass or like at least match the creativity of these already established models like Midjourney, DALL-E, etc., which are there, right? So maybe they've arrived at the table, dinner table late, but maybe they got like really good baked products, which none of these people already had. And the other question that you're saying that what is this world knowledge? So I feel the world knowledge in this is that they're talking about is deeply integrated with their entire Google's knowledge graph that they have, with access to all the real world data that we have. So instead of just learning from the image that we have, image pictures or etc., they are also learning from the text, the structured text as well. Imagine all the Google searches that we've done, all the pictures that I've posted about my sofa that, hey, no, this is not what I want, this is what I want. So that has been kind of added into that historically consistent world knowledge that Google already has. And I think it's extremely important to have any, to kind of create a model which is much more accurate in answering the questions that users might have.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I see this as almost like Google using or trying to use its like advantages in the space, right? It says, lots of people can train image generation models, but we've got the knowledge, right? And so like we have to put that to use.
Yeah, I would trust them. Like even though I've been using many of these other models available, I'm going to use them now because I know for a fact that they might have much more domain-specific, accurate data that I might need.
Yeah, for sure. Kautar, am I just operating on vibes? Is Google catching up, or is this just kind of like table stakes? They're just like able to generate a model which is as good pretty much as everybody else now.
I think it's table stakes. So I don't think it's a catch-up game. They've been working on it. So it's just the time for them. It's ready for the release.
Yeah, right. Natalie, you were laughing. I guess maybe you agree or...
I think at some point last year, I was so surprised and so excited every time I saw an announcement. Now it's like every week something is happening. And yeah, so I think that the space has started to be like people are catching up and it's kind of becoming a commodity sort of situation. That said, I still get impressed by the fact that right now we can say like change my tulips for flowers that are wild and be very focused on a part of an image. I think that was not the case a few months back, and that still makes me happy. So from that perspective, I love seeing more and more models coming out. I think not only Google, but many other players are going to continue improving the models and the capabilities and the ways we describe and get to get some beautiful pictures out of it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I feel like it's really hard to be in the AI business because you're like you're doing like magical things that have never been done with computers before, and then people like 6 months later are like, what else you got? You know, it's like it's very very hard, I think, to like keep ahead. Because I agree with you. I mean, there's almost like announcement fatigue. You know, it's just like what is the next big thing? Well, I don't know. It just feels like there's big announcements like every week. And so all of it kind of like blends in together. So
yeah, I think the key question here, are they catching up or are they really innovating? So I think that's what we need to focus on. So of course you can catch up. You can see what others are doing and try to close those gaps, mimic, you know, or try, because a lot of the stuff, the algorithms, you know, a lot of them is published. But are you really bringing something new here to the table that nobody else has thought about? So I think maybe we should start seeing those more trends, who's the real innovator here who's just playing the catch-up game?
Yeah, definitely. Kautar, I feel like you're a harsh judge. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thanks for joining us. Natalie, Kautar, Vyoma, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And thanks to all the listeners out there. We're going to try something new this week. We're always interested in kind of hearing a little bit more about what you out there are interested in hearing about from week to week. So if you have any topics, you're watching this on YouTube or Spotify, please drop a comment, let us know. We're going to be keeping an eye out on that. And we'll probably work that into future episodes. So flag anything you've seen that you want us to talk about. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. And as always, if you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you all next week on Mixture of Experts.